Right. Good morning. Welcome to the 36th annual year of Management Accounting Research Group Conference. I say it's the 36th year because we actually missed 1 year. We didn't have a meeting 1 year. So it's really 35 years of these meetings. My name is Michael Bomich. I'm one of the organisers. Al Bomani over there is another one, and the person who does all the work is Becky. Oh, he's over there. I thought you had left. I'm very pleased to see so many people here. I'll just say a word or two about the Management Accounting Research Group, MARG. Basically, what it is straightforward. It is that it allows academics and practitioners to get together to discuss and learn about both leading edge research and leading edge practice. In some ways, I think it is the academics or the researchers who need to know about practice, but we don't say that. We've got, you've all got a program which we stick to as rigidly as we can. The lunchtime is in the old building, and there are stewards. Our stewards are in red, and there's one right over there who know everything. So please talk to them. This time we're going to have a slightly different arrangement to sometimes, and we've got two themes. One is really, where after 35 years, where does practice and where does research stand? And then in the afternoon we're going to look at the idea of having management accounting principles. Life is, in some sense, a bit like accounting standards, but for management accounting. That's roughly what we're going to do. There's a buffet at the end. There are notices on the door that tell you where the bathrooms are. There are bathrooms downstairs. There's also bathrooms on each floor. You have to be clever because they alternate between male on one floor, female on the next, and so on. So bear that in mind. I'm told that I have to tell you about the arrangements in case there is a fire. Now, in the past, I would have said that doesn't matter because we never have a fire. We only ever have tests. But last week, it appears the test was taken a bit further than is normal. If the bell rings, then first of all you find a nice orange dressed steward, and they take you outside, and then will take you to the location where you'll be safe. Okay, that's roughly what I need to say, apart from a couple of other little things. One, you know, I'm always enormously pleased to see so many people. There are some new people here this time, and therefore I should say to you that every conference has its own rules. There are some conferences where everything you say in the conference is confidential and so on. Here we have a rule that you can talk to anybody you like. So if you see people, go and talk to them. That's very important because we believe the networking is a very important part of this. Because basically, some researchers are busily trying to find organisations that need to be researched, for example. And I'm sure some practitioners are busy trying to find researchers who might help them solve some problems. So, you know, please do talk to each other. And what I'd like you to do, if you may, is just so you know somebody, here. Could you just turn to the people on your left and right and say hello? And say, where do you come from? You haven't got ears. Right, well, that's enough of that. We don't want your life stories. Right, so now we're almost on time. Being accountants, we're always very pleased with that. We can start with the first talk, which is Mark Waters. I could, for each person who's going to give a talk, tell you all about their distinguished life history. But then there'll be much less time for a talk. So in your package, there is a copy of their CVs, or some CVs. So if I may, can I please introduce Mark Waters from Carlsberg Institute of Technology, University of Amsterdam. I probably pronounced that wrong as well. I'm very good at pronouncing things wrong. Who will probably tell you what on earth his title means, among other things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll explain what the title means, but not right away, of course. This looks like a spaceship. It's kind of typical for where I am, a German University of Science and Engineering. What's maybe also telling about the German scene is that recently there was a survey in Handelsblatt, I believe, and it turned out that if you look at the big companies traded on the stock exchange in Frankfurt, and they looked at where do the people who are in the boards of directors of these big companies come from, the university that has educated most people in those boards, far beyond Munich or other places, is our place. So there's a science of engineering place that where all the top managers come from, so to speak, or most anyway. And that's kind of interesting and intriguing, also if you consider the German economy. It's a great place to be, even if you're a management accountant. So let me start with the key point. And the key point is, well, let's be realistic about how much, but also how little we have to say and what we can learn from others. And we would be people working in practice who need knowledge for certain topics that we would think is management accounting, and it is management accounting, but maybe not only management accounting. Maybe others, people than MAs or management accounting researchers or management accountants, maybe other people sometimes know more about certain topics. And I'll have a few examples of that. And that's because I think, well, management accounting is about things like decisions and the use of data for that and how it affects people's behavior, how we can make plans, how we can provide incentives. And obviously, other practitioners besides management accountants and other researchers besides management accounting researchers have something to say about those things as well. This also sounds very much like human resources, operations, economics, etc. Perhaps even more. That's a question mark, of course. I wouldn't say that's the case, but anyway, that's the question mark. And so my point is that many what we would consider typical management accounting topics are actually researched and practiced more outside the management accounting literature, such as in marketing and operations. So as researchers and practitioners, that's where we should also look for knowledge. That's actually the key point of today. So to make that point even more clearly, I hope, let's look at this one. Modulaire Querbaukasten. What a great German word. MQB. Do not call this a platform. The people at Volkswagen do not like the word platform. It's Baukasten. Now, this is the point. This is an example of something that is super strategic. Now, let's say, first of all, it has everything to do with cost management. This is how Volkswagen... one of the key things they will do to manage their costs. So to me that sounds like management accounting. At the same time, it's a topic, not just this example, but it's a topic that the management accounting literature has very little to say about. So the topic is that if you want to be the biggest car company in the world, and that's Volkswagen's ambition, one of the ingredients is to produce a lot of different cars on the street, a lot of different models that we can all buy. And then the big challenge is to do that efficiently, to not just have a lot of models out there, but to develop them efficiently and to produce them efficiently. Developing them efficiently means that developing a car, 1 billion euros is where it starts. So you have to be careful how many billions you want to spend. So you want to do something that underneath there's a lot of similarity. You develop something, but you can use it in many, many different models that customers don't even see. And then you start producing it, or you start purchasing it. You're the biggest car company in the world, that's what you want to be, and you're looking enviously at Toyota. So you want to have your economies of scale there. You want to have the same part or almost the same part and produce that in enormous volumes or buy that in enormous volumes. And at the same time, you want to make it in such a way that the cars are still distinguishable and are not seen as the same, and they are not the same in the driving experience for consumers. So huge challenges to manage cost, and super strategic. I mean, if you go to Volkswagen's information website and so forth, they will talk about this as one of their key strategic things. It's all about management account, and so one of these things is this MQB, modulaire Querbaukasten system, that produces this commonality in terms of development and producing and sourcing parts for a huge variety of cars. This is underneath the Audi A3, the Volkswagen, the new Passat. A whole range of cars have a lot of the MQB system underneath it. Management accounting, but not a topic. Not an example, certainly, but also not a topic, modularity, that we see a lot about in the management accounting literature. So that's sort of a key example, I would say, and I have a few more. So I'm going to also talk about the focus. A better word might be bias or my own limitations for this talk, and the three examples that are about customer profitability, customer value propositions. Those two points are more, I would say, marketing topics. And managing costs through new product development, such as we saw a moment ago. And if I have time, I have some suggestions for conducting joint research projects, but that's actually something where my colleague Teemu Malmu will say much more about, so I probably don't have much time for that anyway. Michael asked me, and Al, when they asked me to talk about the literature and developments in the literature, that sounds a bit scary because there's so much. So my own limitations there, that I'm really only know much about, or anything I should say, I only know whether it's much or not, but I only know about management accounting for innovations and operations. It's first of all management accounting in my own research and practice, and then maybe also accounting. So it's first of all management, maybe accounting. And I'm really interested in what's happening in the organization outside of the accounting department, where people who are not accountants start to use accounting information. I don't know anything about the financial sector. I don't know anything about top management compensation or the financial accounting, the auditing or taxation aspects of management accounting. So that's clearly my limitation regarding the topics that I can talk about. I also typically work when I have company contacts. They're typically not in accounting. They're more in supply chain, R&D, in marketing, maybe also in accounting, but it's very cross-functional. I also often work with co-authors who are not in accounting. So the more I say, I think, am I in the right place? But anyway. I like field work, and that's also why I have this published in a variety of journals. So let's talk about the first topic, customer profitability. As an example let's talk about how it's seen in the literature. I'll give a few references at the end. And to show that there are a lot of angles in there that are management accounting and that are also marketing. So let's look at customer profitability as something where we try to identify both the costs and the benefits of serving customers in order to improve the overall profitability of the organization. So the idea that we should not just try to improve customer satisfaction and revenues and market share at all costs, but only do so profitably. Whereby customer could, of course, be an individual customer, especially in a B2B situation, or it could be groups of customers. You could maybe ask about the profitability of distribution channels, but maybe the focus is also on just products or group of products or services. Just any relevant cost object where you want to say, how profitable is that? How can I manage that in a better way? And it's heavily researched in marketing. If you just quickly do research over there, for example, I would argue that there's more research in marketing when it comes to customer profitability and managing customer profitability than in management accounting. Let's build it up, to sort of the complexity and the issues that are involved. If you just start to look like back 1 year, 2014, so to speak, how profitable was this customer, group of customers, whatever cost object you want to focus on. Of course, it starts with, and I guess that's where we could do a really good job, being able to trace the direct costs of individual customers, customer groups, etc. It's also an area where modern information systems would be able to do a much better job to capture the information at the point of origin of the costing and say, well, who is it for, what is it for, and can we already make sure that we capture that as specifically as we can, so that we don't have to allocate it anymore, we just know exactly where it starts. There are other costs that are just simply not direct relative to the cost object that we're interested in, so I guess then we can do a really good job, probably better than those other disciplines, in terms of what's a sensible way of allocating the indirect costs to customers or whatever. An issue that is probably overlooked more in our field is the tracing of revenues, which sounds like, well, you know whom you're sending an invoice to, right? So that's obvious. That's a direct thing for that customer. But there's the issue, for example, of capturing sales transactions with different entities of the same customer. There are companies struggling still, even with modern information systems, to say, well, we're doing business with a big customer worldwide or a big customer all around Europe, but they have all these legal entities and all these different names. And so across Europe, across the world, how much business are we doing with large customer XYZ? They're struggling to just put that information together. Sometimes it's not that easy, because maybe I know exactly the invoices I sent to a customer, but the invoice is not the final point. There's a net revenue that needs to consider a few other things. Because we might have volume discounts. So I send an invoice, yes, but then later, but not at the level of that product maybe, but for the total sales, you see this, for example, in fast-moving consumer goods very clearly, there could be volume discounts. And so somehow the invoice sent is not the revenues that is left at the end, but it comes later when you know how much volume discounts you're actually going to give to that customer. There could be rebates that do not go to your customer, but that goes to consumers who send in coupons in shops. So in a way, it's not a revenue. It should be subtracted from the net revenue. And if more customers from one sales channel send in those coupons than from another one, it has something to do with the profitability of that sales channel. But are we able to even track that? Or promotional in-store activities that are paid for. So tracing the revenues is something that is not even that trivial, and that revenue side, I would say, is not mentioned so often, at least in our literature. Or the issue that sometimes there is a revenue number, but it's kind of meaningless because it's a service that you give away as part of the deal. You give away or you price very lowly. So, yeah, you can look at the profitability of that separate service, but it's kind of meaningless because it's usually part of a bigger deal, a bigger package, and it's about the customer profitability or the profitability of that bigger package. This is something you see a lot, for example, when selling equipment to other businesses, and you look at what's the deal for consumables. Sometimes that's the core source of a profit. Sometimes that's actually the sales argument to give them away for low price and get the deal done on the equipment. It's not what we know as consumers when we buy our printers, but it's something that's happening in B2B markets sometimes. Now, this is only measuring profitability for 1 year, but what if we want to measure profitability over the life cycle of a customer? Then, of course, we have the issue that so far up to this point, how is it looking? There might have been initial investments when the profitability looked really badly, but then maybe recently it has already increased, and maybe overall so far we're doing fine or not. But anyway, we can't just look at one a separate period. And then if we would draw the conclusion that over this life cycle so far, needing several periods, this customer is not so great in terms of profitability, do we have any indications, do we have any signs that we can predict whether this would be able to, whether we could turn this around? Could we manage this to become a profitable customer? Again, I think a key question for customer profitability, it's definitely a management accounting topic, But you have to go to the marketing literature to find practical things to do there. You have to go to the marketing literature to find how we can contribute from a research point of view. Things like, could we turn that around by improving the efficiency of our internal or cross-functional or inter-organizational processes? Could we start adjusting service levels or fee for service or certain pricing tactics to influence the behavior of customers? And anyway, are there certain objective indicators that would be characterizing customers that are going to be profitable in the future or that are not going to be profitable in the future? Using the big data, trying to understand the characteristics of customers with good prospects. Even more difficult, and now it really becomes marketing, I would say, is measurement of, well, however you want to call it, spillover effects. Let's say we have an individual customer. In 1 year, unprofitable. Looking at the product life cycle so far, unprofitable. Prospects for turning it profitable, no, not there. Still, could be a good thing to be continuing business with this customer. It could still be a customer that's actually helping us to maintain our profitability, but in a more subtle way, through spillover effects. For example, we might have a customer that is very demanding. It's that customer who's always pushing us to improve our processes, to implement new technology, to go out and do better R&D. And we have done a careful job tracing or allocating those costs to that customer, so that one is looking really badly. But then later we're going to use those same investments in the same technology for others, and then it's quote-unquote for free. They're not charged for that anymore. It's a... Well, I just here call it the spillover effect, but anyway, it sheds a different light of what it means to be doing with that quote-unquote unprofitable customer. It might also be, and these investments, you could say, could even be found on the balance sheet. Capital assets in production, maybe even sometimes R&D as intangible assets, patents, and whatever. So we would at least have something to show for what we did as a result, or what we have as a result of doing business with that customer. But what about investments that are not going to be investments in the traditional accounting sense? For example, there's just a higher initial cost for doing business with that customer that provides learning. We learn how to set up a new process. We learn how to go into a certain market, how to improve business processes. So it's all gone. It's nothing to show for on our balance sheet. It's not an investment, but still something that could be worthwhile for us and making us profitable. Looking at what it means for doing business later with other customers. Or just simply the reputation. Getting referrals from well-known customers or using showcase customers for marketing purposes. What is that worth? Sometimes an awful lot of money. I'm sure some tennis players are not very profitable for Adidas. Actually, they're getting millions to play with their gear. But that's about it. It's about reputation. Now, that's an extreme example. But also, in especially in B2B again, you will see that if you're doing business with certain customers, it's not about how much money you make over there, but it's about being able to say, I sell to XYZ, super demanding, super prestigious customer. So I must be great. Now, just some reference, I'm not going to go through them, but just to, if I look in the accounting literature, there are a few there that talk about measuring and managing customer profitability, but actually it's much easier to find that stuff in the management or in the marketing literature. So, that's my first topic, to illustrate my point. The second topic is also a marketing one, and that's customer value propositions. Now, the key point, it sounds awfully similar. It's customer, and it's accounting and value and whatever. It's an essentially different thing, because we're now changing the scope. This is what marketing people do, and this is a strict B2B story, I should tell. This has actually nothing to do with consumers. This is changing scope, because now it's not about how profitable a customer is for us as a supplier. Now the question becomes, what are the implications, the cost implications, the revenue implications for the customer if they're doing business with us? Can we show to the customer that they're better off buying from us than from our competitor because they will save more costs or they will get more revenue enhancements if they buy from us? So it's, again, I would say it's management accounting. It's about cost savings and what have you. But the scope is different. It's not about our cost savings. It's trying to put ourselves in the shoes of the customer and make that point when we try to sell our offering. And that's why I would argue that I have nothing to say about this when it wouldn't be when it would be about consumers. I don't think it's a very persuasive argument over there. It's about business argument. It's about business markets. And the issue there is that there are all kinds of criteria that customers would consider when they ask, well, should I buy the equipment from this German supplier? Oh, it's pretty expensive, but it's made in Germany. By the way, I learned that made in Germany actually had a history in the UK, because at some point, long time ago, the UK industry was leading. That's what I wanted to say. I wanted to say a long time ago, the British industry felt threatened, this is like in the 30s or so, felt threatened, 20s or maybe even before that, by what could also be the 50s. I forgot. That's not very strong, but it was an interesting documentary. The point was, the UK industry was saying, okay, this is not a good thing, this is not made in the UK, let's make it clear, it's made in Germany. So that's not a good thing, it's like made in... And at some point, we would say made in Taiwan is not a good thing. Now, of course, it's a different story also. And later in time, this made in Germany turned out to be a good thing. So thank for that. So things like performance specifications, energy usage, reliability, references and reviews from other customers, experience that the customer has with this supplier or this brand, delivery times, warranty, technical support. So a lot of different things. And there you are, a customer. You have to make up your mind. And of course, if you have an offering that's better on all of these, that's easy. But the issue, of course, for purchasing managers in B2B markets is how to make up your mind when different offerings are preferable depending on which criteria you use. So what we see in marketing is there's a topic called customer value propositions. And the core idea is to try to, in a selective way, translate all these different attributes into the financial implications for customers to make apples to apples comparisons possible. Well, we have a certain reliability, that's fine, but what does it mean for you in terms of, for example, therefore needing less inventory and therefore saving inventory holding costs? So going from just the feature side or the benefit side in terms of all kind of great things, but not in euros, trying to translate it as a sales argument in B2B markets. So it's defined over there as the worth in monetary terms of the technical, economic, service, and social benefits of a customer company that a customer company receives in exchange for the price it pays for a market offering. And it's not just sales talk. It's intended to be a B2B topic where you have a lot of data to back up that if you have this much better reliability, it means this means that many weeks of inventory less, and it means so much cost savings for that particular customer. So it's about translating the features of an offering. So it's very tempting, especially for German engineers, I can tell you that, to be all excited about the X37B ceramic coated surfaces. So buy this, right? Everybody wants to buy this. It's X37B ceramic coated surfaces. Sometimes very persuasive if the other people even know what it means. But often, maybe not. First step, trying to translate that our marketing colleagues always argue into the benefits for the customer. So what that means is easy cleaning. That starts to become a bit more comprehensible already. And this is where the accounting angle comes in, into what those benefits are worth to the customer. So, for example, fewer labor costs, saving you 17,000 euros per year, and I have the data to back this up. So far, when we talked about customer profitability, we would be this, and we would be trying to understand how valuable is this customer for us. Now we're changing scope. The scope is the potential buyer. What would their cost savings be from improved processes, such as easier cleaning and fewer labor costs, or higher revenues because they, in turn, can sell more or at a better price? And marketing people would then say you try to have to provide this information in a persuasive way to customers, and the management accounting angle is, I would say, clearly there, but we have little to say about this. First of all, it's financial information whereby, as I've said before, the customer is the scope of the information. So I would argue it's management accounting, it's inter-organizational management accounting, because we put ourselves in the shoes of somebody else. The key point is also that we might, some people in marketing push this further than others, but when it becomes really management accounting, when we try to push it as far as expressing this customer value monetarily, not just faster or cheaper or less or so many weeks earlier, but trying to push that and translate that into monetary information, both on the cost side and on the revenue side. What's also important is to understand the customer's comparison point. Well, I might choose from you, but if I walk out of this room and I'm not persuaded, I'm going to do something else. I have a next best alternative. And so what we need to do in marketing terms is express these cost and revenues in terms of differences compared to the next best alternative. And also be extremely explicit, and again, that's something where the core competencies of management accounting could come in really well, about our underlying assumptions and the way we do the translation, because the customer would be looking at that and saying, you know, 17,000, how do you know? Why would that be true? You're just trying to sell this to me. Why would I believe you? If you then can be very explicit with a systematic calculation, say, well, we've done the research. It's so many hours per day. We think, we have assumed anyway, that you operate three shifts a week. We can easily change that if you want. But assuming three shifts a week, times so many hours, times this and this and this. So there will be some customer input data there. There will be some rough assumptions. But by making that explicit, you can have a dialogue with the customer about how that would work. And the idea is not just to use that in terms of selling, to make the offering more persuasive, but also you might learn from that in terms of, well, wait a minute, if I do this, even if I'm not yet meeting with a customer, but if I'm now doing this, I'm discovering that from the customer's point of view, making it faster or smarter is maybe not the biggest thing, but there are other, which are the, more generally stated, which are the most important things to develop further, to tweak from our point of view as a supplier to make it even more worthwhile. So by putting ourselves in the shoes of the customer from a financial point of view, we have a very concrete understanding, if we succeed, in understanding what are the things to push forward to improve and make it a more persuasive offering. So we should be maybe doing more there. Or we could be doing more there. And I'm going to skip this because of the time, but there are implications for pricing considerations as well, as you could understand. And there are implications for R&D, as I've already mentioned. How should you develop? Maybe you want to adjust particular specifications. And some of them may also be less stringent. There might be things where, from an engineering point of view, you have the idea, oh, it's already fast, let's make it faster. But if you then discover that making it faster doesn't make it more valuable from the customer's point of view, that's not what you might want to do. You might also say, well, we have to enable other applications or other operating conditions. We have to maybe develop augmenting services to make it a really valuable offering or add specific features. Some references from the more general marketing and management literature, and also a few from accounting. So my point is, there is really a lot of value in both in practice as a management accountant and in as an academic to be working with colleagues from marketing, because they have a lot to say about things that we would consider core management accounting topics, and reversely, we have a lot to contribute to those core management accounting topics. It's more a management topic sometimes than a management accounting topic. The third way to illustrate that is through the topic managing costs through new product development. Think about the modulaire Querbaukast. It's just a great word. I can't repeat it enough. We all know, and whether we are accountants or managers or engineers, that many costs of our products are determined during new product development. So in a way, if that's the case, if many costs, most costs, we always say 90%, but if you go back to the sources, that's actually very few empirical studies that have really shown that. But intuitively, it's a persuasive point. A lot of costs are determined during. Why are we not, like, all the time, then also 90% in a management accounting worrying about product development, if that's where all the action's happening? It's an obvious lever for managing costs. And the typical topic, almost the only topic in management accounting, is target costing, to talk about that. And that's an important topic, but at the same time, it's only one topic. Because many costs are not just managed through target costing systems, but they are managed because they're not managed for one product. And the target costing system is essentially looking at one product. There's a target cost for that. let's make that happen. But many costs are not managed at the level of one product and one new product development project, but they're managed across a whole portfolio of products, such as component commonality or platforms. And those approaches have hardly been investigated in management accounting. But things like modularity, component commonality, roadmaps, platforms, they receive a lot of attention in the operations and innovation literature. So, briefly, target costing. Two sides of that, the target setting, and then the reviewing of are we achieving those targets. Starting point is always the sales price at the end of the at the customer at the point of sale. For example, customers at the car dealership. And I must say I'm a bit disappointed in most management accounting literature, because then you read, okay, so you have the sales price, you subtract your profit margin, and there you have it, your target cost. Well, it's typically not that straightforward. It's typically a more complex supply chain. Because, okay, let's take the car dealership. And let's say we have a car at the dealer at 30,000 British pounds. But, yeah, and that's where you have to compete. That's where the consumer will look. What do I get for my 30,000 pounds at the Mercedes dealer, the BMW dealer, the Lexus dealer, what have you? That's where they will be looking. What's in it? What are the features? But then it's a long way before we actually get to the target cost. We have to subtract taxes, and they're very different in the UK than in the Netherlands or Belgium or Germany. The costs and also the margins of the various parties from the point of sale upstream. Think about the resellers, think about wholesalers, think about importers. They have costs in between, they have margins in between. So at some point you get to the sales price for the manufacturer, the Volkswagens of this world. They have indeed a target margin, sure, but they also have a lot of non-manufacturing costs. And only then you get to the allowable manufacturing costs. So a lot more needs to be subtracted before we are at that point. And then target costing talks about splitting that up, because that's for the whole product, and in many products, if they're a bit more complicated, you have to break that down to get to the allowable cost of the major components, the engine, the axle systems, and so forth. And if you then have a system where you outsource those major components to suppliers, that becomes basically the allowable price for the supplier of such a component. So that's how it's then pushed down, or upstream, I should say, the supply chain. And in some industries, that's also not given that much attention in the management accounting literature. All this is happening dynamically, because we have a sales price, and we have a margin, and we have an allowable manufacturing cost at different points in time. We have that at the point of launch, when the car is getting to the market first, but then we have a learning, we have a target for a learning process. So there are going to be target costs after 1 year, after 2 years, after 3 years. So it's not even just one number, it's dynamically formulated, these targets. And then there are the design reviews. And there you really have to go to the stage gate systems and the literature in innovation management to read more about that. And one thing we should consider there is that it's not just a cost target, there are targets for many, many things for that new product. Regarding functionality and performance. So you will also clearly define things like, well, not just the price, because we can have any car at the dealer at 30,000 pounds, depending on how great the car is. So you also need to be very careful. That's what these companies do. What features should be in there? What should be the speed, the engine power, the torque, the emissions, the interior noise, the safety, the weight, etc., etc. So there's a whole list of requirements, cost being one of them. And they're not just targets for the product, they're also targets for the project. Because if you're spending $1 billion to develop a new car, or if you're spending a lot of money developing new consumer electronics or cameras or what have you, you also have targets for how much money you should spend on that project, so many millions, so many billions, and when it should be ready, and when it should go to the market. So there's things like development cost, development lead time targets, for the development project. And then, at several stages, there's this evaluation process of the design against these requirements. So we come out of a product development phase. It's much more general in the beginning, concepts, and then further, and making it more and more specific. And then there's an estimation of the costs. That's something we don't know read a lot about. How would you be able to estimate? So the design for a new product is looking like this. It's a prototype. it's looking like this, the shapes are pretty well defined, but the material is still open. How would you be able to estimate the cost of this if a lot of parameters for the product haven't been fixed yet? We're halfway into the design process. It's not a complete product. But still, we already have to estimate, if we proceed like this, if this design is accepted, will it meet the target cost or not? I don't know, because I don't know how the final product will look. Still, you have to make a decision. You have to make an estimate on the cost. But also on all these other requirements. Will it be fast enough? Will it have the engine power that we said we wanted to have? So we have to estimate those things, and we have to evaluate against requirements. Does it meet them? Yes. Then we can move on. It's called the stage gate system in innovation management. If not, we have to go back. We have to redesign. And we're probably also going to adjust some targets. Not just saying, oh, it can be more expensive. It's more subtle than that, because now some of the more subtle trade-offs come into play. We have functionality and performance of the product. We have the cost of the product. We have sales prices and volumes. And then we have, for the project, we have the cost of the development project, and we have the lead time. And there are many trade-offs. So when I say adjusting targets, the literature talks about all kinds of ways in terms of managing target costing systems. And one thing could be to say, well, wait a minute, maybe if we stick to the cost target, but we are a little bit flexible on things that have to do with functionality and performance, maybe that can work, but we have to understand what that means for sales volumes and prices. If we do not offer it anymore with a dual air conditioning standardly, because it's cheaper to have just a single zone air conditioning in the standard, in the basic model, is that acceptable? Or do people not want to buy the car anymore? Fewer people want to buy the car. What's the trade-off between playing with the specifications and the product cost on the other hand? What is the trade-off between maybe spending more money on the new product development, putting in another 20 million to do more product development, to do a better job, hire more engineers, get an outside engineering consulting firm on board. Let's spend another 20 million. Maybe then we are able to implement some of these features. Or we can actually take more cost now, but then actually achieve the target cost. Or take more time and then achieve the target cost. So the trade-offs in a target costing system are much more nuanced than we read about in the typical target costing literature in accounting. And then there is the issue that this is just one product with one target costing system. A lot of things, a lot of costs, I should say, are not managed when we just look at one product. For example, logistics cost. What if our concern is to manage logistics cost in our company? Well, maybe one of the costs, we know these things, right? We know from activity-based costing that, for example, the number of stock-keeping units might be one of the drivers of logistics cost. If we have a warehouse with an exploding number of different packaging things, different products, different recipes, different kind of special promotion products, this is a huge issue, for example, in the fast-moving consumer goods again. That's why the Unilevers of this world have done a very, very extreme systematic job of reducing producing product variety in the supply chain, hopefully in a way. And we really don't care. I mean, I don't have the time for that, but the Magnum example of the ice cream is just such a fantastic example to talk about managing costs. Design costs, probably it has something to do with how many different parts we have in the whole portfolio of products. How many different modules? How many patterns if we have textiles? How many versions of our product? Transaction cost of purchasing, maybe something to do with how many different suppliers we are doing business with. Purchase prices, probably something to do with the volume we buy for each unit, for each type of part, I should say. Manufacturing costs, there could be a learning curve, so we need to have our economies of scale there. And so we know from activity-based costing there are an awful lot of different cost drivers like this. And the point is, attacking these cost drivers and managing costs is associated with complexity in our supply chain, in our product designs. And that requires additional strategies besides target costing, because if we only look at one product, we're not going to reduce our number of SKUs necessarily. We're not going to necessarily reduce the number of parts we have, the number of modules, if we only look at one product and we have a whole range of different products. So that's where strategies like parts commonality come in. Companies use car companies, electronics companies use deliberate strategies to say, you know, these are the allowable parts. So, dear designer, you're going to design a new product. Of course, there's a target cost for that, but additionally, there are other constraints to manage costs. For example, there's this database of electronics parts and approved suppliers and approved parts. That's what you can work with. And if you, for some reason, for your individual little product, would like a part that's not in the database, you can't use it. Just take a more expensive part. Because for your product, it might be overspecified, but fine. In the portfolio, it's still a good thing. Or take a product that is not as good. Yeah, you won't meet all the specifications of your product. Maybe that's the best trade-off. So you manage these things not at an individual product level. Modularity, strategies where firms take a look at how the basic architecture of their products is set up and where they have make life more complex for individual products because they have to fit into the strategy of using a particular modular structure, but overall it allows you to have your supply chain organized differently, to use these modules in different end products, etc., etc. I can assure you that the people who designed the Golf at Volkswagen are not necessarily happy with all elements of the MQB system. It makes their life more complicated. They would rather have the freedom to just do whatever they want, but they're not allowed to do whatever they want because that would just destroy the strategy and the advantages you might have by being almost the biggest automotive company in the world. Or things like postponement of customization, changing the product architecture so that you can keep your bill of material structure common as long as possible, and at the end you start to differentiate it and it's all tied up again with the modularity structure. And also tied up with your outsourcing structure, where if you have bigger parts of your product that are modules that are separately designable, separately testable, you can outsource also bigger chunks of your final product and organize your upstream supply chain very differently. So that's just illustrating that broader approaches that go across several NPD projects are required and are looked at in the innovation and management literature and are practiced by colleagues in the firms who are working in those areas. I already mentioned this example. So some references here, both from the management accounting literature and from the operations management literature. Now, as an academic, you're always who am I to generalize? I'm always thinking, oh, do I have enough slides? But I can easily skip these because we're almost running out of time. So there are a lot more topics where you can see that they're at the interface of accounting and other disciplines, such as human resources, marketing, operations management, things like that. I'm just going to spend 1 minute on this and then I'm closing it off because how much time did I have? 40 minutes, right? So I should be done. Then I'm just going to skip this because you're going to talk a lot about joint research with companies, which is what I had in mind here. So I'm just going to skip this. And thank you for your attention.
'Got us off to a very good start. That I think gives some sort of feeling about where academic research, at least in one area, is at the moment after 35 years or so. And our next person, I should have said that what we're doing, we're not having questions now. We'll have them at the end, having the next paper as well, and then we'll have a discussion. Because I think the two come very much together. And, hopefully our next speaker is going to say the opposite of whatever was said just now. And therefore I'd like to introduce Adrian Ryan, who is an independent consultant, who has also been a loyal member of MARG for a number of years. So he knows what he's letting himself in for. So, thank you.
questions on. How do I get to the presentations? Does anyone know? That's just this one.
They should be down here. This one is yours?
That's mine, yeah. Perfect, okay. Thank you. Oh, this is in the wrong place. Okay, not sure I'm actually going to disagree. I may be doing quite a bit of agreeing, so that's quite interesting. We'll see. When I was asked to give this talk by Rick Payne of the Institute, I was a little bit taken aback to realize I had 25 years of a career to look back over. So Rick, thank you for that insight into my mortality. Although the way things are going with retirement age and pension tax legislation, I think I probably have another 25 years to go. So we could think of this as maybe a halftime talk. The good news is there's more goals and scores in the second half of a game than in the first half, so I'm generally optimistic. At one point I will make, just on the title, picking up a little bit on what Mark was saying perhaps, I work in finance, not accounting. I haven't really been an accountant since I left Pricewaterhouse 20 years ago. That may be relevant for the discussion in due course. Also picking up on what Mark was saying, I've tended to work cross-functionally as an analyst rather than, shall we say, in the back office processing. But I'll get into that in a little bit. Yeah. So just what I'm going to go through is, this is an opinion piece, that's what Rick asked me for, so I'm going to give you a little bit of context as to where that opinion is coming from. I think that's relevant. It's definitely not an academic presentation. There are no references here, unfortunately. And then I'll talk a little bit about what I think are perhaps three of the biggest developments that I've seen over the last 25 years in terms of the finance function. Let's talk a little bit as well about where I think we are today. That's the halftime talk. And perhaps do a little bit of crystal ball gazing. So we'll see how that goes. So because it's an opinion piece, I kind of need to give you a little bit of a sense of where that opinion is coming from. I don't normally do this, but I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. So my formative years were Pricewaterhouse and Procter & Gamble. Classic Pricewaterhouse, ICAW type training. But I also did a couple of years in corporate recovery. The main reason for that was I started my career in the teeth of a pretty bad recession. And so obviously corporate recovery was where it was at. A couple of the big jobs that I worked on was the Bank of Credit and Commerce International collapse and also the Maxwell Communication Administration. At Procter & Gamble, I guess I could say that was my formative training in industry, shall we say, maybe what a lot of people here might think of as management accounting rather than financial accounting. A lot of the work there was around Central and Eastern European emerging markets in particular. That was a very big area. The euro was introduced during my time there, so I did a lot of work on euro pricing corridors, which was quite interesting. You may not be surprised to know that the companies did rather well out of that, the consumers less so, and that was my fault, at least for Procter & Gamble. And also, there were quite a number of initiatives in Procter & Gamble at the time, all to do with tax efficiency and centralization. So moving to global business unit or organizational structure, European supply company. Streamline Logistics, you mentioned logistics, Mark. I was involved in Streamline Logistics projects. And customer business teams. Customer business teams in Procter & Gamble at the time was a new innovation where instead of simply sending the sales guys out to meet the customer, we sent out a cross-functional team, including marketing, logistics people, and finance people. And so that was a very interesting time to be working at Procter & Gamble. Then I went and joined an internet company. I listed a business on AIM, I liquidated another one, and I did a turnaround of a third. And then I joined the Disney Internet Group as their divisional finance director for EMEA. Two big events around that time were the advent of wireless and commercializing wireless content for Disney, and of course the move from narrowband to broadband. I was also divisional director of Thomson Financial, which was delivering technology services software services to the financial services industry. And then I decided to become a consultant and did something completely different based on my heretofore experience, which was create shared services for British and American Tobacco and do a number of cost optimization projects for the like of Sky and Total. But I also did quite a lot of finance and performance management type of projects as well, whether that was introducing scorecards or dashboards, KPIs, or indeed the dreaded business partners for Airbus. So quite a broad range of different areas that I was working in. And I guess I brought that all together in my final role, final so far at least, the halftime role, with Imperial Tobacco, where I was director of finance transformation. And that was a cross finance transformation, but also into IT strategy, chart of accounts design, and procurement. So that gives you a little bit of a perspective on where my opinions are coming from. Before I go into the next context, I just thought I'd share a couple of perceptions of finance. You know, how was finance considered back then? This one's probably self-explanatory, I think. I hope so. And that's something that I think still drags on today, the notion of accountants being bean counters, in particular the back office type of accountants, the transaction processors and so forth. But if you think that the financial analysts escape lightly, they don't. When I was in Procter & Gamble, actually, I was speaking to a new boss who just arrived, and I was asked by one of the marketing directors that I was working for who that was, and I explained who it was. And he said, oh, that's the SVP's walking calculator. And I was not very impressed with that assessment, as you might imagine, especially as he was basically inferring that I was his walking calculator. So, interestingly, that guy, the boss who he was talking about, was a guy called Jeremy Darroch, who some of you may know, is now the CEO of Sky. Not bad for a walking calculator, I would say. But this is a serious point here, that there is and remains a perception from non-finance people that finance people are somehow subservient administrators, back office, not to be involved in the business. And that is a barrier to us achieving some of the things maybe that Mark was talking about, actually. And so we should bear that in mind, perhaps. So the next context I wanted to share with you is what happened over the last 25 years, at least in terms of some of the major events that put in context the work that I was doing. As I said, I joined in the teeth of a recession. I joined Pricewaterhouse in the teeth of a recession. And connected to that were a number of corporate scandals, such as the infamous Polly Peck collapse, which gave us the phrase, cash is king. And it was amazing to me that cash wasn't king before, but there you are. And coming out of that, of course, there was changes to the financial statements. We then had the cash flow statement appear. And the Cadbury report. Now, speaking to some academics that I do some work with, I sit on the Institute of Chartered Accountants Research Advisory Board, and the topic of governance comes up quite a lot in that discussion area. And I'm not really sure if Cadbury made any difference whatsoever, but maybe that's a discussion point for later. At the same time as all of that recession, and of course the recession drove a focus on costs. That was a very obvious thing that was going on at the time, drive to reduce costs. At the same time, though, there was a massive tech boom. During that same period, while there was a pretty bad recession, worse than the one today, at least that's the way it felt to me. Of course, there was a housing bubble crash and interest rates were sky high. There was a friend of mine at the time who announced that he had got a great deal on a 10-year fixed rate interest rate for his mortgage of 9.99%. I mean, even then I was questioning that, but by today's standards, it's insane. But while all of that was going on, computers were getting faster and smaller, laptops were appearing. During the first 5 years of my career, we went from what was effectively a hold-all-size computer to a satchel-size computer to something that looks like a laptop today. That's in the space of 5 years. And car phones, the big clunky Del Boy-type car phones, turned into something pretty slim by the end of the 90s that pretty much everybody had. Companies like Oracle, Big Blue, sorry, not Oracle, IBM, Big Blue, got rid of their hardware business, sold it to Lenovo, and changed their business model to focus on consulting and delivering technology solutions. I don't know if you know the IBM story. It's really quite fascinating. They were on the verge of really collapsing before they did this sharp turn, and they turned that around in a very short space of time and have been hugely successful as a result of that. And that led us to the internet bubble and, of course, the infamous first bubble burst. I might point out that I joined an internet company pretty much on the day the bubble burst, so don't ask me for advice on what to do when it comes to investments. I'm rubbish. But it was a fascinating time to work in that industry. Of course, again, we had some scandals. We had the Enron and WorldCom scandals, and that gave us the lovely SOX legislation that so many of us, unfortunately, have probably had to deal with. And Arthur Andersen went down as well, which is a little bit perhaps closer to home. Again, cost saving was very important, but finance was now being asked to do more than just cut costs and manage the purse strings. We needed to add more value. Stuff like balanced scorecards was emerging, KPIs was emerging, and we needed to be on top of this. And at the same time, we needed to bring in all of this new technology that was arriving. Excel, it seems strange, but Excel was a new thing back then. It was very liberating. And still, after 25 years, analysts are still using Excel. So maybe that got that longevity because it's a useful tool. Also, maybe because other systems hadn't really quite caught up or given us an alternative. But that is changing now. There are a number of other solutions that are coming to the fore right now. So the internet didn't die. Everybody was calling the death of the internet, but it didn't. And wireless just exploded. Well, we know that now where it's got to. Broadband appeared, smartphones, social media, and all these kinds of things appeared. And a burst of information that we as finance people, in particular anybody who's working in financial analysis, had to deal with. Probably not very well during that time period. And now we've got concepts like big data, which are kind of bringing these things all together. And then we had the credit crunch. Just as we thought everything was going well and we'd finished the recession and we were getting a nice boom, we got the credit crunch. Now, it's interesting to me because, again, there were more corporate scandals. You're beginning to see a bit of a theme now here, I guess, with the corporate scandals. Although this time it was mostly reserved for financial services. And again, there was cost reduction requirements and focus. Now we think maybe we're out of that. Now, I don't know about you, but it feels to me like maybe the recession actually isn't over yet. We have quantitative easing. We have zero interest rates. We have an asset bubble. What's going to happen next? Well, we might talk about that a little bit later. But I'm wondering whether we're heading into choppy waters. One thing's for sure, there's a lot of share buybacks going on right now in listed companies. There's a spike in M&A. There's very low interest rates fueling a lot of this stuff. Is there actual real growth? I'm not sure. And a lot of commentators are predicting deflation. So I suggest that maybe we could be in for another round of corporate scandals and cost saving once again. A couple of overarching things that were going on around that time I just wanted to share with you. The first is globalization. Can't underestimate the impact that globalization has had on the way we do business. And emerging markets, not just for growth opportunities, but also in terms of operationally how we work. I mean, obviously a lot of business has been sent to emerging markets in terms of shared services, outsourcing, offshoring, that kind of thing. But also a lot of companies have evolved in this space in India and China that are competing now with Western countries. So that boils down to three main focus areas for finance, I think. Cost saving. Okay, I won't say too much more about that. Also data visibility. That's really the point about finance being asked to provide more insights, to add more value rather than just the traditional role that they perhaps played. And globalization makes that more complicated. A lot more data makes that more complicated. And I'm not entirely sure if we're actually trained to do this job. So that's maybe a topic we'll discuss in a little bit. And risk management and governance. We've had Cadbury's, we've had SOX, we've had a bunch of other things. When I was working in Procter & Gamble, that manifested itself in a requirement to embed risk management into our financial analysis, which was a very good thing, but so many companies don't do that. They're still doing very straightforward financial analysis, which from my point of view only scratches the surface and doesn't really consider all of the potential scenarios or the sensitivities around major decisions that companies are making still today. So these three focus areas, in my view, generated a number of major impacts for finance. Shared services. The advent of shared service centers around about 20 or so years ago, that really started. And that's been a never-ending journey, and it's still ongoing today. IT, of course, the IT development, both in terms of major systems like ERP, but also other tools. I mentioned scorecards, but the IT support tools that are coming out to manage dashboards and KPIs and the dissemination of information, the analysis of information, consolidation tools, and so on. It's really very complex these days. And balance scorecards and this business partner concept or title that we inherited from HR, actually, which is a title that I can't stand, but I put it up there because it's unfortunately well recognized. It's really financial analysis. It's about finance embedding with the business and working with others to put a different perspective on decision-making in particular. And of course, there's corporate governance. Now, I'm not going to talk about corporate governance much today because that's really a topic for a whole talk. So let me focus on three major developments right now. First is IT. ERP, consolidation tools, FP&A tools, fast close tools, scorecard and dashboard tools, some of them very complicated, some of them more straightforward, publishing tools even internally, if you want to think about it, that inside a company. In particular, transaction process automation tools such as optical character recognition, e-invoicing, three-way matching, automated workflows. These are empowering tools for mechanisms like BPO and shared services. What we call in consulting terms, enabling technology. It helps us do things that we would like to do, but until these tools appeared, couldn't really do very successfully. Now, interestingly, I still get into conversations with people about the fact that OCR doesn't really work, or e-invoicing is not really very successful. And that is a memory that they have from 10 or 15 years ago. But today, I can tell you that it's extremely effective. In fact, it's so effective that now the latest stuff that's coming out literally in the last couple of years is robotics. They literally call it robotics. So it's taking out all human interaction from invoice coming in through to posting and even through to payment, which means there's no people involved in transaction processing except supervisory and control. That means that finance people, if I want to call it that, have to be experts in systems, or do they? Maybe we need to do more outsourcing of these tools to people who really know how this stuff works. Outsourcing server farms and SaaS, software as a service offering, very big these days. You don't want to, I was speaking to a FTSE top 50 company recently. They wanted to put in a new ERP system. Normally companies are doing massive SAP implementations or Oracle implementations. BAT spent over $1.5 billion putting in SAP recently, and it's still ongoing. This company only wants to spend $15 million. They're still a FTSE top 50 company. So they're looking at maybe Oracle Fusion, which is operated on a SaaS basis. So it's massively reducing the cost of these things, but still gaining the majority of the benefits from major ERP. And social media and big data. These are massive events, and in particular social media and big data, that have not really been fully thought through, understood, or were not really geared up to take advantage of. And so at the moment, if you're not, it's a competitive disadvantage, but it's also an opportunity. And it's not going to go away. Technology is going to be remain a dominant force, in my view, for the second half of my career, I'm sure. And being technologically savvy is going to be very, very important. Oh, sorry, before I move on. One thing I just wanted to say on technology. Finance has not taken the lead that it should have, I believe, in industry on technology. We leave it to IT to just get on and do it. IT people, if you speak to them, desperately need business partners, people to work with, when it comes to developing technology. And most of the finance organizations that I've worked with, they don't really want to get involved in it. It scares them. Now, some of the decision makers, of course, are perhaps of a slightly older generation, and I understand that. But even some of the younger guys, yes, they've got a smartphone, and that's all fine, but they don't really want to get involved in some of the heavy-duty finance, IT stuff that is going on today. And this is a mistake. I also think that the main reason, and one of the things I will say, is most of the major systems implementations that I've seen or been involved with or come in usually after to fix are abysmal. Terrible implementations, very bad ROI, they don't deliver on what's been promised. And there are many reasons for that, but one reason that I find is consistent is a lack of data strategy. Companies will have IT strategy, but they will not have data strategy. When I asked this question, actually, in a couple of other conferences, I asked a group of about 150 people to put up their hands if they had a data strategy. Only 5 or 6 out of 150 put up their hands. And you're talking about some of the top companies in the world. The 5 or 6 were mostly internet or technology companies like Amazon, so no surprise there. So there's a huge void here and a big opportunity for finance to take a leadership role. Shared services, it's interesting. Still today, there are people who are negative on shared services, naysayers. It doesn't work. We'll never do it. I don't understand that. I think shared services works. That's a fact. Now we're looking at evolving shared services. Obviously, there's outsourcing. That's already happening. But also looking to get more value out of shared services. And the key idea here is compartmentalize all of those things that you have to do, the statutory compliance stuff, the transaction processing, the stuff that is just good hygiene factors. Make it as commoditized and cost-effective as possible and focus the rest of finance on the business, working with cross-functional business teams, making good quality business decisions. And if you do that, you will not only reduce costs, you'll be able to get into these things like data strategy, management information, and influencing business decisions in a more effective way. It's about global business services these days. It's about integrated business services these days. So it's not just about creating a shared service center for finance anymore. What do I mean by integrated business services? This is where you manage a process, a full end-to-end process within that one environment. So P2P is no longer purchase to pay, it's now procure to pay, i.e. procurement, sourcing, all the way through to the payment. And the same thing for order to cash. So you're bringing customer services together with finance, together with banking operations into one organization. This is about administration, actually. At a round table recently, I suggested that, as an example, invoice processing was not finance. It's administration. I don't care, as a finance director, who does it, as long as it gets done well and to good quality with good controls. I got some negative reactions from that, by the way, from a guy who joined Pricewaterhouse with me, a good friend of mine. He didn't like that idea at all. And the interesting thing is that shared services is inevitable. That is going to continue in a variety of different formats, and resistance is futile, to quote Star Trek, the Borg. I don't know if any of you, I'm a science fiction nut, so you'll see a few science fiction references, perhaps. But the arguments that come against shared services, against outsourcing, even against the use of technology, are often emotional arguments. They're fear that I don't like technology anyway, fear of loss of control, fear of loss of empire in particular is a big one. And they're dressed up in the clothes of logic. But shared services is a fact, and it will continue. Now, perhaps my favorite one is business partnering. As I said, I really don't like this term. I'd forbid the use of business partnering as a term if I could. It's really about financial analysis. Actually, years later, when I was a consultant, talking to somebody about business partnering, I realized that I was a business partner when I was back in Procter & Gamble. I just didn't know it was called business partner. It was just financial analysis. And we worked with cross-functional teams, again, to pick up on something that Mark was talking about. This is how you make financial analysis a reality. You cannot sit in isolation and just analyze numbers. Business partnering, or financial analysis, or business decision-making is about understanding the key drivers. It's interesting, when I get into conversations with people about deploying KPI dashboards or scorecards, they always talk about, oh, we need a blend of financial and non-financial measures. And I'm like, I don't understand that. I think that's kind of garbage. The real issue is business drivers, focusing on the business drivers. What influences the financial outcomes? What influences the numbers? That's what you really need to understand when you're a financial analyst. That's what your KPIs need to give you an impression of what's going on. And you need to add that insight. You can't just deliver a KPI dashboard that's going to tell everybody everything that they need to know. I mean, it doesn't really make sense. The one thing I do like about balanced scorecards is the fact that you are looking at it through different lenses, so we're not just having a financial conversation. But really, when you look at it, it's about having a conversation about the business drivers and the risks to those business drivers and the opportunities that we may have and making the right decisions accordingly. So actually, I'll show you one just for fun. This is actually a scorecard that was used at a client of mine. I won't tell you who. And this was prior to the work that I did to design a better scorecard. So you can see all the elements of a scorecard there, but I would challenge anybody here to put their hand up and say they would find that useful if it landed on their desk to give them an understanding of what's going on in the business. I mean, smiley faces, frowny faces, okay, fine, the red ones are not so good, but why? Now, what you had to do was click on and go through and find stuff, and it becomes a real nightmare. The other thing that you'll notice from that is there's hundreds of them. Where do you begin to look? Now, I'm not going to give you a talk on scorecards, but I just wanted to emphasize the fact that what a lot of people have done over the last 10 or so years is go crazy designing wacky scorecards and dashboards and forgetting why they were doing it in the first place. They forgot what they needed to keep their eyes on in the business. And it usually boils down to half a dozen of the most important things. Now, quite frankly, and I get shot for this, I couldn't care less about staff turnover and stuff like that. I mean, you know, okay, someone's managing it. If it's an issue, we'll see it. But is it really something that we want to see week in, week out? It doesn't change much. You know, staff satisfaction is another classic. Maybe we do a census once a year. The KPI never changes. I mean, what's the point? You know what I'm saying? All I'm saying here is we have to be a little bit realistic about some of these things. So where are we now? Well, we've got all of the pieces. We've got technology. We've got shared services. We have more financial analysis, I think, now than we had. And, of course, there's a bunch of governance and risk. But that structure often doesn't exist in companies when I go and work with them. And certainly, even if it exists, it's not been leveraged very well. We still have pressure on cost to serve. Finance shifted from looking at the business cost to its own costs quite a while ago. And even though we're down to maybe 1-2% of revenue, actually a lot less in many cases, we're still being asked to reduce our costs. And it's very difficult to take ownership of IT to derive added value if we're constantly being pressured to reduce costs. That's why the leverage of technology and things like shared services is so important. So finance isn't where it should be. I think that's my halftime team talk theme. Why not? Governance is still a problem, and we're going to have more scandals, and we're probably going to have more compliance, and it ties us up, and it keeps us from really focusing on the business, important as it may be. And I believe that governance is important, but I think it's maybe a topic that needs to be addressed at government level, lobbying level. The institutes need to get involved in that, and for sure we're going to see more scandals. Resistance is futile. Resistance to shared services and BPO is a waste of time. I think it needs to be embraced if you don't have it already. And it needs to be leveraged to its max. And here we can actually also improve our technology situation, because most of the BPO providers are rooted in IT. IBM, Cognizant, some of these companies are rooted in IT. And now they're expanding into the process side of things as well. And most of the consultants now are already talking about integrated business services rather than having a shared services just for a function like finance. So it's cross-functional shared services, actually, not just cross-functional business working. This is my biggest bugbear. Siloed working is protectionist. People want to maintain control of what they've got. They like what they've got. The more people they have reporting to them, it seems, the more they feel empowered, and that's no good. Also, you have to get out from behind your desk, especially if you're an analyst. You have to work with other people from other functions, and frankly, I would prefer to see companies actually structuring cross-functional business teams. That's what I had in Procter & Gamble, and it worked effectively, really effectively, and still does today. And this issue of not taking data ownership of data, I think we as a function can really own that. Finance can own data. Right now, in many companies, we do not. It's patchy. We own some, but not everything. And it's very difficult for us to influence how that data is presented, how it's rendered, how it's analyzed, and the kind of investment that we put into it. And I think we're losing out in analysis. I'm now talking about accountants as such rather than finance in general. A lot of MBAs are trying to do analysis better. There are companies who are hiring engineers, scientists with PhDs to do financial analysis because they cannot get the financial analysis that they need. And I think this is an area where finance as a profession is losing out. And we're lacking leadership on this. I would like to see more leadership from the institutes on this. I mean, you know, it's not for the want of trying. I know Rick and the guys at the Institute, at least, have done a lot of work around some stuff on business performance and so forth. But also, there's a lack of leadership from CFOs. When CFOs become CFOs, it seems like they don't really want to be, especially when they become CEOs, they don't really want to be seen as finance people anymore. And there's a lack of investment in this area of financial analysis, in this area of owning data. I would say that I don't think that accountants necessarily make good analysts. That doesn't mean that an accountant can't be a good analyst, but if we want to become analysts, we have to change from being accountants quite early in our career. Within 5 years, I was already getting trained as an analyst. I think it's very difficult to take somebody who's worked in traditional accounting roles for 15 or more years and try to make them financial analysts. It's a different skill set. So perceptions of finance now, still the same, actually, unfortunately. I think it's better. It's not as bad as it was 25 years ago. I mean, we are adding more value. We are working more with financial analysis. We are working more with technology. And we're delivering our own cost reduction through things like shared services. But I think that for many companies, there is a big opportunity to get much closer with the business and add a lot more value. So what about the future? Well, I think it's safe to say there'll be more scandals. I think if I came back in 25 years, I would be proved correct on that one. So governance is going to be a continuing issue. There'll be a lot more technology. I think I'll be proved right on that one too. I think outsourcing, areas of the business that are deemed not core will increase in pace, not decrease. Actually, perversely, there will also be some in-house flows as well, as technology allows companies to actually manage as efficiently as outsource organizations. There'll be a bit of that as well. But in the main, I think certainly large business will shift to saying, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I want to focus on the core business. And they'll simply eliminate the problem by outsourcing. Big data, and by big data I really mean the drive to get more quality financial analysis or business analysis cross-functionally and leverage technology and other sources of data such as social media and so forth to blend a bigger, more comprehensive picture. I think that's going to happen big time, and that will also prove a competitive advantage for those who do it. And risk management associated with everything will continue to be a major theme. So what do we need to do? No surprise, we need to take ownership of data and analysis. If we take ownership of data and the technology behind that and actually say, we as finance will be the people who pull all of this together, working with all of our cross-functional colleagues to give a different perspective and to give a comprehensive view of what's going on in the business through the main business drivers and also through risk management, I think we can have a massive area of success there. I think we need to embrace these new ways of working, this resistance to things like shared services and outsourcing, resistance to effectively compartmentalizing traditional finance jobs such as the invoice processing. This is a mistake. We need to embrace this. The resistance is futile, and also at the same time we need to get out of our silos and work much more closely with the business. It's only in working closely with the business will you really understand and be an effective analyst, and it's only in doing that also will you gain their trust and have them asking for more. Now, sometimes I think that has to be driven in an organization by leadership, so I go back to my leadership point, because it's very difficult for an individual to change the way a company works. So a company needs to say there's a better way of working and this is the way I want to do this. But also the individuals need to be asking for this and wanting to work this way. And above all, finance needs to add value. Yes, we need to continue to do the things that we've always needed to do the accounting, make sure the reporting is good quality and timely and so forth. But really, business wants to see finance helping them to make their objectives, which usually at the end of the day is about money, often about remuneration as it happens. And getting better at actually reading those internal political signals, I think, is also very important. But we mustn't underestimate the fact that finance will still be seen as the guardians of the corporate assets, safeguarding the corporate assets. It's one of the first things I learned in my accounting training. Still today, that will be very important, and in the future, that will be very important. So it's a fine balance that a business partner or financial analyst has to tread here. On the one hand, you want to be with the business and helping them and not saying no all the time and figuring out ways actually to say yes, but at the same time, you need to know when to pull the brake and say, guys, I'm sorry, this one's just not going to fly. It's actually an extremely difficult job. If we don't, I believe, as a profession, we will be marginalized to the back office, and I've already said the back office is dwindling down to nothing because technology is taking over, so I don't see a future very much. I mean, there'll still be headquarters centers and reporting and so forth, but you know, I think we can do a lot more. And we need to grasp that, and we need to do it quickly, because believe me, others are doing it. And I'm on time. Excellent.
Academic, I spend a lot of time with slides. When I come to a place like this, I realise that other people are much better at slides than I am. You know, really good pictures and things. Maybe we lack the technology in universities, we don't get the money or something. But thank you very much. I thought there was a nice contrast between the two presentations. I quite like the last one because it's always worried me. Whenever I go to any sort of thing like this and people get up and speak about accounting, they're always miserable. At the end, they always say, well, on the other hand, you know, but they're always miserable. I thought Mark wasn't miserable. He was giving us a guide to the future. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to discuss the first couple of sessions for a while, and that should take us nicely up to lunchtime. So, if you would, if you have two things really. One, if you had a question, please say who you are, where you come from. Secondly, you're welcome to give your views, that exercises in terseness would be appreciated. Okay, so who would like to start us off? Sir. There's a microphone, by the way. Do not try and talk without a microphone. This theatre is specially designed so that... Even so, do, please.
Okay. Oh, that's fine. Ramji Balakrishnan, University of Iowa. And this is to Adrian. So I agree that finance professionals should broaden their scope, understand data analytics, provide value. I mean, these are statements that I think are hard to disagree with. But as an academic, what should I be doing as an educator of accounting professionals? What should I be doing given the constraints in terms of available time in the classroom? Because if I started teaching people about analytics, about computer programming, about other things, I'm going to have a 7-year or an 8-year program and I would have 0 students. So what should I do that universities are not doing right now?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that. Maybe Mark has a view. Interestingly, I studied engineering for 4 years before becoming a chartered accountant. So I did have a 7-year program, as it happens. Maybe that is the answer. I don't know. I think it's enough to start with to give people a good, solid awareness of what's going on. I'm not suggesting that finance people need to be IT specialists. There are IT specialists for that. The trick to this is having sufficient technical skills and knowledge to be able to have a quality conversation with an IT specialist to get what you really want. That means needing to understand how the systems work. So, for instance, I get into conversations with SAP experts a lot. These are IT people. They start to try and tell me about accounting. And then I say, okay, hold on a second. I know you know how the system works, but that's not what we want to achieve. We want to achieve this. Now, can you tell me how we can do that? And really, it's about educating people to be able to have those kinds of conversations. Financial analysis is a little bit different. I think financial analysis can, and I think is, taught in many programs. So really, I learned it as well when I was doing my ACAs. There was a whole subject on strategic planning and financial analysis and so forth. It was my favorite topic. It was the one I was really interested in. So I think that side of things can be done easily. And the rest, of course, people need to learn themselves. You have to just empower people to get out and continue their own education. I don't think you can teach everybody everything in a university environment or even in professional exam environment. I don't know, Mark, if you've got any views on that.
I think the idea of being able to work in cross-functional teams is really important. And some of the things we might do in teaching is try to sometimes teach things in a slightly more integrated way, being more explicit without wanting to cover everything, but trying to be more explicit how something we talk about in our accounting class relates to something that's happening elsewhere in the program. And it doesn't mean like redesigning everything, but maybe making some more explicit links. Maybe sometimes involving a colleague from IT to give a guest lecture in your class and the other way around. Maybe trying to build modules where I don't even, that's actually what I'm doing, for example. I have a module called Cross-Functional Management Accounting. And I know that there are a lot of courses that are related somehow to what I'm doing. And in this module, the students have to take this advanced management accounting class and something else of a defined set. And I let them explain to me what's an interesting interface topic. And so I learn new things as well. So I agree, we can't teach everything, but we can open up people's eyes and abilities to work cross-functionally.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, I think that's absolutely right. One thing that I would say is the technical side of being an analyst is not the big deal. I mean, people learn Excel, they do it themselves often. Some of the best modelers I know, they just picked up a book and they learned it. That doesn't make them a good modeler. What makes them a good modeler is asking the right questions, knowing who to talk to, and putting that all together. And that's how you can add real insight and make good business decisions. Being a really good modeler and knowing, you know, certain analytical techniques is not even half the battle. So I absolutely agree with what Mark is saying.
in the audience, we have a number of people who spent their lives trying to teach the things you were talking about. I'm just wondering whether anybody has anything else to say about how you do go about, if you believe in all this stuff, how you go about teaching it in universities, or shouldn't you, or should we stick to, you know, good old fashioned stuff, or should we move much more to the frontiers? So.
Good morning. My name is Simon Preece. I'm a certified accountant employed by the Ministry of Defence. My question to the panel in terms of teaching is that in order to achieve what is known as the deep approach as opposed to the service approach, and to encourage what is known as the student-centred experience of teaching opposed to the teacher centred approach. In terms of technology, how should one go about using technology as a teaching aid? Should one use technology remotely, using, say, narrative PowerPoint or other technologies? Does that actually enhance teaching or does it not? Which is the best way to promote teaching? And in terms of technology expenditure, in terms of, say, if you're looking at, for example, as you mentioned, in terms of data as opposed to IT, how do we best allocate resources, in what direction? Bear in mind the sudden changes in technology have caused in huge increased costs, and sometimes technology has become obsolete as a result. Thank you.
That's an interesting one, because I think indeed that I think we've been saying these things for a long time, and so far not much has happened, but that doesn't mean it won't. I think the big thing will, one of the things we will see is that there's going to be pressure on how we do basic, large-scale lectures, and how we might be able to siphon off some of the resources used there to more challenging and more individual teaching. There was a time, and maybe it's not so strong anymore, when in teaching land, at least in the Netherlands, and I've heard it from a colleague as well, was everything was against great big halls with 200 students in there for a mass lecture. That was all wrong. I think that's, personally, I think that's the most efficient way to teach basic stuff. It would be bad to cut it all up and have the same thing repeated 25 times. But then the question would be, why should we do that? Why not have the best people in the world, the best lecturers in the world, explain basic finance and accounting and just get that on video and outsource it? Why should, if I'm not the best teacher in the world, why should I be doing that for our students in Germany, for example? And that might lead to a situation where we have more time to have this cross-functional, spend more time on working with smaller groups of students and challenging them and trying to let them go out and also maybe do more internships or more practical problems, more case teaching. This might be already, I mean, LSE might be another place, but of course many of us work in larger institutions where we also have big groups of students and some of it is quite anonymous. And I think for the basic stuff that's all right, but a lot of the things we talked about might come about later in more smaller scale and more challenging in interactive types of teaching.
So I'm not a teacher, although I have hosted and run a number of courses in industry. I think from my experience, all I can say is I find straightforward lectures very tedious, where I have to take lots and lots of copious notes in case I miss something that might be examined. In the end, my perspective is a lot of people attend lectures to pass the exams, not to learn. It's not black and white, of course. I've always found that I learned best doing. I'm the sort of person who doesn't read the manual for the latest piece of technology that I've got. I just dive in, make mistakes. Once you realize you're not going to break it, it's fine. You should see kids, how they learn today. Kids are far more tech savvy than even my generation. I say even my generation. My generation effectively grew up with computers, although we didn't have the easy access. So we went through the evolution of technology, which I think maybe means that we're used to ever-changing technology. But the kids, they just go, technology, normal, right? And they're messing around on their phones and their tablets, and they're amazing. They never read a manual. They just do it. So maybe you should structure a little bit more time for people to just do things. If it's financial analysis, if it's using techniques and tools and software, and that's actually probably going to be much more valuable than having some person say, okay, here's how it works. The other thought occurred to me, I always liked guest lecturers because they came in and they talked to me about what was really going on in their workplace. So I think potentially that could help. I mean, it could help also what Mark's talking about in getting people to think about how things are done in practice, the ways you have to go about things, the ways you have to engage with other people, which you probably don't get very well from a lecture, I'm guessing. So maybe that's another thought.
Right, one more on that theme. Yeah. Is that really afterwards? No, the one here first, and then...
Thank you. I'm Hebe Elsaid from Manchester Business School, and I'm very much interested in this conversation because actually I teach information systems and I teach management accounting. And I can see the sort of dilemma that we are looking at here from both when we start to look at from the student's point of view, when I start teaching and talking about management information systems and why they're doing it. They are all accounting and finance students. And this is, for some of them, this is a compulsory course as part of their accounting degree program. And it's very difficult just for them to understand why they are doing this and to convince them why this is important and how they should perceive the importance of this. It's just very difficult to teach information systems when it comes to accounting students at the undergraduate levels. So it is very challenging, and unless you put a lot of effort in terms of explaining how this is going to affect them career-wise and become very explicit about how the different opportunities that will be available for them, this is the only way to attract and grab their attention and their interest in the subject. But really, although technology is very important, but it is very difficult to talk about it with undergrads. The other thing is actually with the academic community. So that is the other problem. When you start to present the interfacing between accounting and information technology to accounting audience, academic audience, it is very difficult as well. I've been to one of the conferences, and there was a session, and I was a discussant, and the two papers were interfacing accounting and information systems, and there wasn't anyone in the room. All the people, all the academics were in other rooms, and there wasn't really many of them in the room when it comes to the discussion of accounting and information system. The link is not even clear there. So my comment is that it is always a dilemma from both the academic community as well as from the students' community. So.
Let's see if Professor Scapers can sort that out.
I have a perspective on that. I mean, when I was studying information systems, let's be honest, I found it really tedious. It wasn't what I wanted to study. And I think when people in industry are informed, usually not offered, but informed that they're going to run a systems implementation program, they just go, oh, no, okay, I'm going to start calling recruitment consultants. It's not what I want to do. I think you only realize a lot later how important it is. I think if you focus on the applications rather than the information technology, then you might get a little bit more traction. And if you can get people to understand they're going to be using this stuff, it's going to actually be very critical for their career development to not just use it, but also to have a very good knowledge of how it works. But they don't need all the technical details and all that stuff. So if you shy away from that and say, look, this is practical applications that you will be using when you start to work, and if you don't have this, your career is not going to be that successful, maybe you might get a bit more traction.
Right. Thank you.
Just to add one comment to that. I'm not teaching accounting students. We have an industrial engineering and management program. And there you see a completely different situation. But coming back to the point you were making, other people are ready to take over and marginalize the accountants. I can look at my own students. They're eager semi-engineers, semi-business people. They're really in the middle. And so they don't need to be, they just love IT and they jump onto it. So that's just one group I can see immediately, like, being not happy but ready to marginalize accountants if they don't take up on this challenge.
Oh.
Bob Scapens, Manchester Business School. I want to do something, talk about something totally different, and so maybe change the direction. It's more concerned with the nature of analysis and practice and what analysts do in practice. And I want to link it to what Mark started with on customer profitability analysis. And in that presentation, you really some interesting issues about how to do it, but then the problems. How would you do it over the long term? How would you do the spillover effects? And so on. And in the other parts of your presentation, you talked about the complexities, is it the interconnection between this and that and so on. So everything is very complex. Now, going back to customer profitability analysis, as somebody trained in accounting or finance, however you want to define it, when you think of the customer profitability analysis, there's spillover effects. Well, how do we put them into the numbers? How do we capture the long term? How do we get the numbers right so we know what the true, if we know what such a thing is, customer profitability is for that customer? Now, that's one way of approaching the problem, and that may be our traditional training causes us to address the problem in that way. An alternative way of dealing with that same problem is say, well, we've got these customer profitability analyses. They show these customers make profits, these make losses. But we need to discuss that as a management team, as part of the business partners. And we need to be able to look at these other things. We need to do this on a fairly periodic basis. What is that periodic basis? And so this comes at maybe a different direction. Rather than say, get the numbers right, what numbers do we need to start this discussion? These are profits, profitable, these are not. This is other information which tells us about possible spillover effects. This is other information. Who are the people then that need to be able to talk about this, to be able to do this at the right time, whenever that might be? So it changed our focus from getting the right numbers to bringing the context in which the right people talk about the right things at the right time with the right set of information, not the right answer. So it comes back to the analyst not necessarily providing the final decision, get it all down, here's the numbers, but pushing inputs into decision processes, taking a leadership role. This is what I was thinking when you were talking about leadership. Enables the accountant, finance person to take a leadership role, not in terms of giving answers, but in terms of providing the context within which people can talk about their problems, these very complex problems with lots of different issues, in a sort of an environment which is created to enable to do that on in terms of the right timings, the right place, the right people. And that's something that we're maybe not trained to do. Coming back to the point you were making, we're trained to say, let's get the numbers right. I'll shut up there, Michael. I know.
Yeah, I was talking a lot about getting the numbers right, but of course it's all as an input for a discussion. And again, that's where, whether you're an accountant or have a marketing background, you need to be extremely, not flexible, but you need to be the person who can bring sense to that discussion, who can be part of that discussion, and not just sit there and say, I have the numbers, and now I have nothing to contribute to this discussion. So I think the leadership and the business partner role, let's avoid that word, the leadership and the analyst role, is very much about having the data and then being able to put them in context and being part of the discussion and drawing conclusions there. What also I think maybe has to do with the teaching point earlier. I'm also wondering at which point should you make in the teaching or in the career the distinction between the two. To put this in perspective, if you're thinking about traditional teaching in a finance and accounting program, there's a set package of courses that people take. That's one possibility to look at it. I'm not sure whether it's the same person who is necessarily a great champion of implementing bang, 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 the shared service center in Malaysia or in the Philippines. and being a super person in terms of managing those transaction accounting processes, for me that's not the same person as the one who is getting the numbers right, but who is this kind of analyst and part of the discussion. In terms of skills and knowledge and experience, those are different, quite different people. And again, to just put another perspective on this, in our school, which is an industrial engineering program, I hope I'm not scaring anybody, we don't have financial accounting. It doesn't exist. There is some basic training in it. I don't have a colleague who is a professional in financial accounting. Auditing doesn't exist, not even in the teaching. Finance, a lot of it. And then since 3.5 years, hey, the first management accountant is on board. So you can also think about becoming analysts from a completely different background. And then I would argue that being an analyst, you're not necessarily heavy on taxation issues. You're not necessarily heavy on financial accounting issues. You don't care about auditing. That's another story, another profile than becoming an accountant and a transaction process, which is a super important job, but it's another job. And we are very traditional in terms of finance and accounting. Oh, can be this, can be that. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I agree with that. I remember when I first went to Procter & Gamble, my boss informed me that I was no longer an accountant, I was an analyst, and I was quite shocked because, you know, I'd spent a lot of time training and had my certificate, and after a while I realized he was right. In Procter & Gamble, the way they addressed the problem that you're talking about is they followed the 80-20 rule. That was the first thing that was drummed into me in financial analysis. The 80-20 rule, for anyone who doesn't know, is you get 80% of the benefit for 20% of the effort, which mitigates against maybe the accountant's training of I must get the number right to whatever number of decimal points. I never did that as an analyst. It's much more important to use your training to understand the key business drivers, the key elements that you need to put into your analysis. One thing you do have to do, though, is you need to get the information sufficiently correct so there's no arguments over the data. Otherwise, you spend all your time, and that's happened a lot, arguing about the veracity of the data rather than actually what it really means and what you should do about it. So the way companies like Procter & Gamble address that is they have what's called an economic data sheet. It is a mechanical way of producing the numbers. It isn't 100% correct because there's nuances customer to customer, but within the margin of error, it doesn't matter. And that takes all of that argument out of it. It's very formulaic. The data is now produced by a shared service center, so the analysts don't even do it themselves. And they do exactly what you said, which is they take their information and their financial analysis from having walked around and spoken to people, and they bring that into the right forum, cross-functional forum. And the analyst never makes a decision, to your point. Never makes a decision. There's a very clear decision, delegated authority of decision-making in Procter & Gamble. It's less clear in many other companies. The analyst is responsible for making sure the right decision-maker makes the right decision and has sufficient information to do so, and the right issues are discussed. The decision maker can override. That's up to them. But interestingly, in the delegation of authority at certain levels, if they don't have a concurrence from the relevant finance person, they cannot make the decision. So that gives you a certain amount of power, but you're not a blocker, and I think that's very important. And just on one final point, a lot of the work that I do is creating the right operating model, the right forums with the right people at the right levels, plural, because they tend to ladder up, to do exactly what you just said. But there's a huge number of companies that simply don't have that. It's amazing how many.
Thank you. Yes. Being an accountant still, it's almost time. Can I just say two things, though? One is that if you go into a lecture theatre today, it's quite different to what it was before, in the sense that today, or before, students sat there and looked at the whiteboard with PowerPoint, you know, and so on. Going there today, they've all got their laptops in front of them with the screen erect, you know. And now they could be looking at the slides that we give them much earlier, or they could be doing something entirely different. Who knows? But it is, you know, I think that is in some sense perhaps the death of really big lectures and things. The other thing I wonder, I and some other people looked at some very big firms in the UK, and you know, a lot of them were trying to have analysts and so on. And two things that happened there. One was that if an analyst was any good, he or she disappeared into management somewhere, and that's the last you saw of them. The other thing was that they found that these sort of super-duper people needed data. They also found that their organisations had enormous silos. You know, the marketing person isn't going to give the accounting person the data very easily, to say the least. And so in some sense, there's an enormous governance management problem there. Well, that's sufficiently gloomy for today. I'm sorry the questions were not, the question time isn't very long, but you are welcome to, I hope you do, discuss things over lunch. Before you go to lunch, I think it's the right time for me to thank our sponsors, at least the first time. Our sponsors are the, I know I nearly always do it in alphabetical order, but today I'll do it the other way around. The ICAEW, who have been with us for 35 years, and SEMA, who joined slightly after that. We're very grateful for them to be such strong supporters of this sort of endeavour. So can we give our sponsors a little... Now, lunch is around the corner. You come out the door here, you turn right, go as far as you can. First road you come to is Houser Street, turn right, and you'll find our main building there, and the lunch is on the fourth floor of that. It's called the Fourth Floor Restaurant. Please do not leave any valuables here. We're entirely honest and straightforward, but please do not leave any valuables here. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.